Okay, so welcome to the Constructive Use of Pain, Crisis and Failure. And I'm going to go through this. We've got a nice short session and let's see how we get on with that. I'll just outline what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to take a few stories of variously pain, crisis and or failure. I'm going to talk a little bit about how I think about areas where things can go wrong, horribly wrong or disastrously wrong. And then a little bit about both how we take on what we learn from pain, crisis and failure, and then a little bit about the personal effect of feeling a failure or feeling that things have gone really badly and how that might affect you as an individual rather than as a kind of academic intellectual process. If all else fails, get a dog. So I'm going to start off, if I may, with pointing, like a lot of acts, people point to the people sitting at the front of the audience and get them to embarrass themselves. But this is not embarrassing, this is sharing. And as we've talked about before, a safe space to just review and think about some examples. And Graham has very bravely offered to give me our first story of what a difficult experience might be. So Graham, are you still up for this?
Absolutely, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, can hear you. Okay, that's great. So Graham, give me just a couple of minutes on your experience, please.
Okay, so this is one of hundreds that I could come up with in terms of failure, but this one learns to a lesson with hopefully a couple of takeaways. You'll see, and you won't see my pointer, but the bottom left picture with a fairly not expensive but well structured game with cameras and you can see that the group of people sat around it, and although you can't quite see him, one of the guys with his back, so on this side of the table as you're looking at it, was the commanding officer of that unit. And this story all pertains to leadership, and I don't know if Stephen Downs Martin's here, but he would say you recruit, you do not invite your attendees. But the point here is that we were having a very good interactive game, but the commanding officer, the leader of this particular unit, saw this as a bit of an imposition, and he was dealing with lots of administrative issues and the rest of it, and basically just grumbled about the whole thing. Now, his people got on with it and they were really getting into it, and then he breezed in at one point and sat down opposite me, and after about 10 minutes he tutted and he pushed his chair back and literally folded his arms and said, "Oh, for God's sake, I've got better things to do." At that point, and I turned to the guy you can see sat to my left, who was actually the sponsor, if you like, and I said, "We might as well go home," because everybody else in the room sat back, folded their arms, and that essentially was the end of that war game. The lesson is, when you pick the leader, you will be given the leader, but make sure that you get that leader engaged. And you'll see the difference with the top right picture, where actually the commanding officer is the second up from the left. And that is what I call active learning, where you have some table dancing going on, because we had warmed up that commanding officer, so he was thoroughly engaged. My two top tips to this is the things that leaders like to hear, I have found, is knowing that wargaming is active learning, and will give people a more engaging experience than pretty much anything else. But the one that really gets them is when you tell them they are the leader and they have to encourage their people to operate in this safe to fail environment, a phrase that we've used a lot. But the point is, identify the leader and make sure they are thoroughly engaged. Otherwise, you might as well go home. End of message. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Graham. And that's a really good example of a transition from something that really didn't work to something that was an exemplar. So Tom, are you around?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, let's move on to Tom's story.
Okay, so I got asked to run an example war game for the commando, one of the training officer in one of the commando regiments. Said he wanted to introduce wargaming, and could I provide an example of it? So of course I was ready to go and dashed off down to their location, and they'd suggested they do a generic wargame, And I said, you know, for God's sake, you must have some real things you're planning for. And they were like, oh, well, we could try something for this. And I said, really, you know, how about something you're actually planning? And they said, well, one of our roles is of forces protected evacuation in the Lebanon. So getting British citizens out of Beirut. So we turned up, they had all the mapping and were ready to go. And I ran it as a free brief between the two organizations. We had some enemy and we had some friendly forces. And then we had, of course, a, sorry, I'm getting huge feedback from somebody somewhere. Any ideas where that's coming from? Okay. And the we had a US Marine who was playing the enemy. So it looked amazing. Anyway, we started playing. And as the game progressed, I was running between the two groups, you know, friendly and enemy, in a Kriegsfield manner. And I lost track. And the timings, one table thought they were at one time scale and the other thought they were at another time scale. And of course, the ship was at a different time scale. And by the end of the game, I'd completely cocked up the timing. And the guy said, yeah, that was a really good idea, but you know, we have to get more control over the timing. And I hadn't run it on fixed turns. It was just by key events and it had got horribly mangled. So I returned thoroughly chastened to my room and sat down and thought, how do I get control of this? And I came to the conclusion, which I thought was genius, was to buy a load of those toy clocks that you get at school and then have one of those at each table. And that would remind us exactly what the timing was. Anyway, while I was thinking about this, I looked at my library of illustrations I've got on Wargaming. And Jim, if you can call the next one up, the slide. Yeah, this is the classic picture of a Kriegsspiel taking place in the officer's mess in some Prussian unit, where we see the red and the blue and the umpire table. And in the background is a massive clock. And it's like, oh, for God's sake, you know, you've been doing this for years and you didn't think about actually having a clock, which is the thing that really sticks out on this picture. So I felt like a complete idiot and I carry my toy clocks around with me everywhere from now on. That's me.
Thank you, Tom. Yes, so it's also interesting to know that that some of the problems and some of the pitfalls we come up against are not new. Thank you. So yes, mine. Well, I've got a couple of very quick examples. Some time ago, this is in the context of historical war games, so not so much in the professional field. But I was involved in designing a game about the 1813 campaign in Germany, and we organised a day-long campaign game, operational, high-level, grand strategy for about 80 players. And everybody had was completely ready for this. They were, you know, people had booked in, they got their day laid out, ready to go. We started playing the game and they made peace. Halfway through the day, Austria and France made peace. And so we were faced with a room full of 80 people who didn't have a game to play, because there was no point carrying on once peace had arrived. And that was quite an embarrassing moment, awkward. How do you feel the time? And what was interesting about that was that myself and the others involved in designing it, but had failed to have given players complete freedom of action to act as heads of state. And it never occurred to us that in 1813, the Allies would make peace with Napoleon, because historically they didn't, and it's probably a really, really bad move, but we just didn't think it through and realized we'd given players options that we didn't want them to take, i.e. we said, yes, you can do whatever could be done historically. So that was quite a major cock up and quite an embarrassing moment, but learning to construct your game around what's not just what's realistic, but what you want as a range of possible outcomes. That was the first one around that. And the other thing in the same game, we had some versions of the game which worked better, but we had a combat resolution system for major battles in which we had an outnumbering system. We had combat odds, we had strengths, and it was all worked out in fine wargaming style. And the problem was that the battles didn't seem to come out like they had done historically. And it took a while to realize that concepts like 3-to-1 wasn't a thing in the Napoleonic Wars. Armies didn't fight like that. And we had to kind of take a step back from what I thought I knew about combat to what questions I had to ask. And so going with the familiar, and it's interesting that I was listening to Evan de Salandro's talk earlier about comfort zones and about doing things in areas that you're familiar with, that notions like combat odds are very familiar in particular games, but combat odds aren't the same in different historical periods. So went away, the good news was, took that really poor game, really poor combat resolution system, and created something that's a little bit more subtle, a little bit more interesting, and maybe a little bit more realistic. But it took running a number of quite large scale games and some really unsatisfactory moments to really kind of hammer the lesson home. So we've all had this, we've all got, I think it's been quite an interesting exercise to sit and think about those moments where we talk about you either fail or you learn, but to come up with concrete examples of where we've done that, where we've genuinely, where things maybe go wrong for different sorts of reasons. So I've got a few very quick categories of failure, which is again, as usual in my talks, this is the world according to Jim, it's got no credibility other than that. The first one is failure in development. And I think to some extent this relates to Graham's example, but it's the incomplete client conversation. Have you really got to what is required in this game? Because if you haven't, or if you haven't engaged your client or your sponsor sufficiently to get, either for them to get why they're doing it or for you to get what they need, which might not be what they asked for, you run a category risk for failure. And so that's an area where I have certainly had experiences where we thought someone else was going to be doing some aspect of the event, when in fact it was us. Second category is in the planning, forgetting the obvious, turning up an event where your game is driven by a PowerPoint presentation to be displayed on the venue's projector when the venue doesn't have a projector or a screen or a power supply. And then thinking how you can run your game like that. The planning, and you know, planning is everything, the plan is nothing. Actually, planning is pretty damn useful. When you're running a professional event, you do need to get that right. And that's an area where that specific example I have had. So converting a game that was designed to run on PowerPoint to one that runs on shouting was quite an interesting exercise. In the execution, another example was of a game where a map encounters game, where one person had volunteered to generate the maps, someone else had volunteered to generate the counters. The person generating the counters made them four times the size of the map scale, and we didn't discover until we were setting the game up. So the execution is also pretty important. That's partly a planning, partly an execution, but there are all sorts of things that can go wrong during executions, we all know. And finally, there are those games or events where just one damn thing after another happens. Everything goes wrong. You turn up and the venue's locked. You've left half your rules behind. The players haven't received the briefings. the concept for your game has got no bearing on the subject matter that the client really wants to do, and it's snowing outside and you've got soaking wet getting there. Those things will happen that are outside your control, but it really does help to have, sometimes I find, to have experienced those and to have some idea of if you can't do anything about it, what you might do when, as it inevitably will, it happens. Okay, so we've run our game. Something went horribly wrong. It's failed to achieve its objective one way or another. Some part of the game is broken. Some aspect that players are deeply unsatisfied by, or you're deeply unsatisfied by. Can we learn from that? Well, of course we can. And some things that I tend to use to approach benefiting from pain, crisis and failure are these. The first one I find most useful is don't be precious. So being defensive about your game. So when somebody says, well, yeah, but you didn't do that very well, or that didn't quite work, or you didn't explain that properly. Even when you know damn well you did explain it properly, you have to step back from that defensiveness. You have to step back and, okay, that was their experience. And the trouble with being defensive about your game design, or even about your process, or any of that, is that it makes you blind to development. If you can't step back and just accept and consider. And that brings me on to the next part. When you've had a bad experience, listen to your critics, especially if you don't like what they're saying. It doesn't mean you have to agree with them. It doesn't mean that they're right. But if you listen carefully, you may find that there are germs of improvement which are valuable. And so, and this is connected with don't be precious, stay with that careful listening, and they will be saying uncomfortable things, especially if you don't agree with them, but they may still have something that you can learn from. Consult with others, so you're not alone. Generally speaking, we hunt in groups. There will be others who will talk to you about it. You can talk to people who are involved in the game who maybe weren't involved with the running of it, and consider feedback. Not all feedback has to be taken on. Not all feedback is equal. And so there's a judgment element in which you listen to these things, you're open to criticism, but you are objective about the value of what comes in. And then finally, don't give up. And God knows I've had this experience. You do a game which is a complete turkey. You come out of the end of the day, you think, that's it, I'm never doing that again. I'm giving up. I'm going to live on an island somewhere. This is dreadful. This is the worst game I've ever done. I'm utterly useless in every aspect of game design. Now, whether that's true about me or not, don't give up, because you will have spent some time and effort building something, which even if it's not fit for purpose, the purpose that you have presented it for in the first instance, it may be fit for some purpose. And there is always some element of something you've done, even the turkeys, even the things that have failed, that can be repurposed, reused, or incorporated further down the line in an appropriate space. So don't give up, even if you are convinced that it should go on a fire. And collect lessons. So this is the other part of, really, the other side of that. So you've got criticism, you've got commentary, you've got lessons potentially learned. Collect those lessons. Now, whether you collect them in your head or whether you keep a repository of lessons or a checklist, some people really like a checklist of things that I must remember next time. And the good thing about the really, really bad failures is you will never forget them. But the ones that are maybe the small lessons, it's worthwhile collecting them. And as I say, lists can be quite handy for that if you don't remember them. So that's, if you like, how you might approach the learning process from a specific, if you like, from a kind of academic intellectual perspective. But there is a personal impact, and it can affect us emotionally. And I think we would do well to pay attention to the emotional impact of something which either we perceive as a failure, or we're told is a failure, or in various ways has not come up to whatever standards, personal or otherwise, we aspire to. And so the thing that I would head up my commentary on personal aspects, emotional aspects of failure, is you are not the game. You may have designed the game, you may have put your heart and soul into your game design, but you are not the game. It's the game may have failed, but you're not a failure. And I know that's a little bit, you know, woo-woo kind of UAG in some ways, but there's a truth in there, that it's over-identifying with the activity can lead you into this deep despair, which you don't need and is not justified. So just remember that you, whatever you've done to create your lovingly formed game, it's not you that's the failure, it's the game, and it can be fixed. And remember that you're not broken. Secondly, when and certainly I've experienced this, I've come out of a game going, oh yeah, this is dreadful, I'm really miserable. Allow recovery time. Go and do something else. I know some of us are super busy and we're leaping from one thing to another, but even if that recovery time is a really long bath or a long swim or a cycle ride or run around the park or anything that isn't the game, take time out for yourself. And before going back or reviewing or doing any of the intellectual stuff, just try to let it all go and put yourself in a completely different environment if you can. And the more traumatic the experience, the more important that is. There's a tendency in a professional environment, I feel, to have almost a kind of, oh yeah, no, we can take it, we'll bounce back, you know, we're professionals, but you're also human beings. And it's important to take that self-care seriously if you want to continue doing what you do without suffering burnout or worse. So take that, allow recovery time. That is not weakness, that is a strength, and it's about building your resilience. Avoid playbacks. So the other bit that we all tend to do is to review and repeat and remind ourselves and go over and over those horrible things that were said about your beautiful game. And again, that's connected with the timeout. Just try very hard to keep, when you feel yourself repeating over and over again in your head what went wrong, distract yourself with something nice. Talk to people, go and do something. I mean, for many of us, go and play a completely different game. Go and play a game that you know works and that you love. Go and have a laugh with mates on a really silly game, if gaming is a thing. But whatever it is, break that. If you feel the broken record going round and round your head, you've got to break it out further and stop it. If you want to feel, you know, that you, if you want to benefit, and this is not just about self-care, which is super important, but it's also about giving yourself the psychological space to be able to take on board objectively the lessons, the serious lessons of what you've just done and what went wrong, what didn't go wrong. Don't give up. Again, I've said that in the previous slide, I say that again here. Avoid "I'm never doing that again" state, especially avoid saying it out loud, because then you feel you've got to not do it again because you said you were never doing it again. You might not feel like doing it again. You might not feel like putting your hand in that mangle again. But the way I like to look at it is, well, I don't feel like doing it again now. If I had to do it again, I had to put my hand in that mangle, I'd make sure I've got the heavily armored glove on first. Or alternately, I've switched off the mangle. So, because if you go into the "I'm never doing that again" frame of mind, then you're not taking on board any lessons, and you're not really able to. You will develop, but avoidance, like defensiveness, cuts off the opportunity to learn and develop and improve your practice. So finally, the four books, again, it's not essential to read into the background of this. These are four books which are, I think, recently have come to my attention, which I quite like. Black Box Thinking is particularly good on how to take on board, how to creatively use disasters and failures, a lot of real world examples. Rebel Ideas is about thinking outside of boxes and how diversity improves your thinking, and I think those are quite useful tools. Conscious Business is about it's not really about business, it's about effective communicating and listening, particularly difficult messages which can come out of failure. And Accidental Creative, as I read recently, is really good about how to keep your creativity. And this, we are in a creative business in terms of game design, how to keep that creativity alive when you are massively overextended, or when you're just reaching burnout. Todd Henry's got some very helpful, practical, sensible advice on that. On that bombshell, I will draw my presentation to a close.